Syrian children killed and injured as the war drags on. Human rights organizations look for ways to get urgent aid into Syria. World leaders prepare for Geneva too. 2.5 years since the war began, we're asking who's responsible for this prolonged crisis, what stands in the way of a diplomatic solution, and how the region and the world is being affected. Stay with the debate for more.
Terrorism continues to ravage Syria. This is the aftermath of a bomb blast in a Shia neighborhood of Homs, which claimed at least a dozen lives, including those of children. Aleppo was hit by a salvo of mortars, which killed several people. Children were also among the dead in Aleppo. The Syrian government blames such violent acts on foreign-backed insurgents. The militants have frequently resorted to similar attacks in recent months as they have lost more and more ground to the government forces countrywide. This is while the insurgents have been continually receiving weapons and funds from the foreign supporters. The victories of the Syrian army have prompted the Western governments, including the US and its regional allies, to end the Geneva Conference too on the agenda. Many countries have been invited to the event, including Saudi Arabia, which Syria considers as its arch enemy. Many in Syria regard Riyadh as the main culprit behind the destruction of their country. The US has blocked efforts to invite Iran. Washington has subjected inviting Iran to, quote, withdrawing its forces from Syria. American officials have also on many occasions criticized Iran and Hezbollah for what they call propping up the government of President Bashar al-Assad. Many believe that the main winner of the conflict in Syria is the U.S. Though on the face of it, Washington is pushing for a cessation of hostilities in the country. Accordingly, Washington also considers Syria's battlefield as a magnet for al-Qaeda militants and extremists who end up dead at the end of the day. But it's the Syrian people who have paid the price for the conflict that's ravaged their country over the past 2.5 years. The situation in Syria has been described as nearly catastrophic. The International Committee of the Red Cross says that the war has left 500,000 people wounded across the country. The ICRC also says the wounded are often not cared for properly and the chronically ill often do not receive the treatment they need. Despite such warnings, Syria's regional adversaries have refused to give up what Damascus calls their heinous plans for the war-torn Arab nation.
You're watching The Debate. Joining us now live from London is Sukant Chandan, an independent filmmaker. And with us live from Washington, Richard Wheats, Senior Fellow and Director of Program Management. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for being with us. I'll put my first question to our guest in Washington. Mr. Wheats, another day of violence. We're seeing more children being killed. Of course, a lot of innocent people, civilians, are caught in this battle. Who is responsible for dragging this war on?
It's hard. I mean, you can't, if you're going to lay responsibility, then clearly there are a lot of people and actors that are continuing the struggle. And so that would be the Syrian government, the insurgents, their foreign backers, and so on. But with respect to the particular problem with the children, that appears to be related mostly to the lack of consideration by the combatants for humanitarian principles of war. And this is, we've seen this with the government dropping explosive bombs from helicopters in cities. We've seen that from the insurgents attacking urban areas and so on. So it's really something, I think there's enough blame to go around.
Would you say that the threat from the rising extremism in Syria is the bigger threat, at least now?
In terms of what's causing the civilian casualties, that's hard to say, because we've seen these kind of casualties in many types of conflicts involving many different types of governments, insurgents, and so on. So it's really just the nature of modern warfare. You have a lot of armed groups, very much a lot of firepower, and a lot of violence. If you're asking me what are the main obstacles to a peace agreement, then I'd be more inclined to say the growing extremism of the resistance is a major problem. Mm-hmm. But that was a conscious strategy, as far as I understand, on the part of the Assad government to try and shun aside the moderates and portray the conflict as a struggle between them and something worse, which in this case are the extremists. And so far that strategy is working.
Let's bring in Mr. Sukant Chandon on this as well. Now, Mr. Chandon, ahead of Geneva 2, a lot of observers are talking about the obstacles in the way of peace. Do you agree that extremist groups are the main obstacles? And do you agree with the comments by our guest there that the nature of modern warfare means that the US government, the extremists and all fighters are, you know, even if we don't say equally, are to some extent responsible for the civilian casualties?
Good evening, sister, and to all your viewers. I think the primary responsibility has to be laid at the doorstep of the governments in London, Paris, and Washington, who have much more than any other political entity on the planet been shown to have absolute vested interest in regime change against Syria for many years, if not decades or generations. If we see the situation that's taken place since the emergence of the Arab Sting, or NATO's Arab Spring Clean, perhaps, in the region, we can see that these death squads or Contras, wrongly called rebels or even revolutionaries by some misguided brothers and sisters, are absolutely conducive and facilitate the main strategies for the governments in London, Paris, and Washington in this era and in the era going forward for the next 2 to 3 decades. The importance of the next 3 decades is this, that these governments recognize that this is the timescale window of opportunity to close down the rising ascendance of the global south, particularly alliances with India, China, and Russia. And what they've done through the Arab Sting is to degrade strategically those alliances that are taking place. And the watchword and the slogan is very much not just divide and rule, which is still going on, as we can clearly see with Syria and Libya, but it's divide and ruin, divide and destroy. Because if the West can't have it, so goes the rationale of the so-called West, then we will never allow Russia and China and India and other BRICS and allied global South nations to have a functioning, stable, bilateral and multilateral alliance with these countries. So really, if we're going to understand the extremists, and it's a false dichotomy between the so-called moderates and extremists, they're working hand in glove. If we're going to put the responsibility with extremists, it has to be the London, Paris and Washington governments, who through their proxy governments in the Gulf states are fueling the extremists in the lead up to Geneva 2 in attempt to sabotage anything positive coming out of Geneva 2.
Well, let's put that question to our guest in Washington, Mr. Weitz. Now, we know that Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Turkey, Mr. Weitz, have been accused of giving finance, giving even weapons. Especially Turkey has been accused of giving safe havens and giving militants the ability or the capacity of it to use its border area and its territory to launch attacks on Syria. Do you think that before this can be stopped, Geneva 2 is even going to be helpful? Because even the Syrian government has been saying that if this stops, a large part of the problem is going to be solved, this support that even extremist groups are getting.
The insurgents are gaining, be able to use the logistics and support centers in Turkey, some parts of Lebanon, some parts of Jordan, and receive considerable assistance from the Gulf states through these various paths. The government receives considerable support from Russia, Iran, and Hezbollah. So it's hard to argue that any one country bears more responsibility from the others. And I particularly object to the earlier statement that it's the Western powers, since they pretty much adopt a standoffish attitude towards the conflict. It's true that if President Obama had resorted to force, perhaps invaded the country, they might have been able to suppress the violence for a while, such as you saw in Iraq. But it would come right back. So it's not clear to me that anything the West does is really going to have much of an impact. They're pretty minor players. I really would think that the local combatants in the countries we talked about, Turkey, Iran, et cetera, are the main drivers.
So what about those reports that, speaking about CIA-trained militants, for instance, in Jordan, do you think they don't exist?
It's possible. I know that the military has been working with the Jordanians, U.S. military has been working with the Jordanians to deal with the contingency of what would happen if the chemical weapons became loose and fell under the hands of, or looked like they fell in the hands of Hezbollah or Al-Qaeda or something like that. But that problem seems to be resolving itself. The CIA, whatever training it's doing, it's obviously not very effective. I think that it's really a marginal role the West is playing. It's not a major national interest, as we saw during the debates, whether to intervene or not. Who wins in Syria? The government, we've dealt with Assad for decades, as he and his father. We could get a better government, but we could easily get one that's worse if the extremists emerge on top. And I think most people are just trying to not get too involved in this one.
Well, Mr. Chandon, let's talk about the U.S. position on Iran's participation in Geneva II. We heard that it has put preconditions for Iran's participation, and Russia said that that decision was counterproductive. Why do you think the U.S. made this decision, and do you think that it is vital and key for Iran to take part in Geneva II?
Well, absolutely. You know, despite whatever criticisms anyone may have, including myself, of Iran, it remains clearly the case that Iran is the main obstacle to total medieval Gulfy and Western hegemony and control of the region. And so Iran is very much an important player in creating stability in the region. And indeed, it's the resistance axis led by Iran, including Syria, Lebanon, at least the resistance movement, Hezbollah there. And also, despite all the quite profound contradictions, the Iraqi government are the forces which are delivering any semblance of security strategy for the people of the region. All other forces, nearly all other forces, excluding Algeria, who is still in the crosshairs of Western regime change, and we'll see increasing funny games in relation to Algeria, who remains one of the most important resistant Arab states in the region. But nevertheless, all the other entities are absolutely fueling destabilization, terrorism, death squads, etc. I mean, just in response to Mr. Weeks, in terms of the Western powers having a hands-off approach, a six-month bombing campaign by NATO against Libya doesn't seem very hands-off to me and a few other observers. And the reason I bring Libya is because Libya was an absolute fundamental regime change and scorched earth strategy of the Western powers to facilitate the continuing destabilization of the region. And that's why they want, through their Gulf allies, to continue extremism in Syria. Now, Thomas Friedman from Stratfor think tank made a very important analysis in relation to the compromises and the machinations with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Basically, his point was that the West have achieved all that they could achieve through the Arab sting, and they're going to fry bigger fish with China and Russia with the pivot to Asia. So really, the West have achieved a lot of their strategic aims, but that was ground to a halt, their rolling strategical and tactical actions in the region through Hezbollah entering the resistance in Syria, through Qusair, through the changes in Egypt in removing itself from the regime change kind of alliance in the region, and the Russians and the Chinese putting an absolute red line to it. So now, because of the Syrian patriots who have stopped the extremists rolling kind of achievements and then rolling that back, the West was forced into some kind of negotiation and compromise with the Islamic Republic. But as can be seen in stopping Iran going to Geneva II, they will continue to play their deadly funny games in the region.
Mr. Weitz, the question here is, those who are against this war are saying that the safety and the existence of Syria as a country is at stake here. I mean, Hezbollah said recently, Syed Hassan Nasrallah, its leader, said that our presence in Syria is because we have strategic concerns and we think the entire region is in danger and that's why we have to take action. And he did say that the action we've taken is not a larger type of action, it's minimal, but our concerns are strategic. You see, you were telling us that the Syrian government is getting help, but the militants and even the extremists at the same time are getting a lot of help, aren't they? So don't you think that if we want negotiations to go forward, we should stop all kind of funding, especially to the extremist groups who, the reports we're hearing from Syria, they're threatening civilians, they're promoting a very fundamental and medieval style of what they call Islam, etc. It's a danger not just to Syria, but to the region.
Yeah, I agree with most of what you two have said. Libya was a clear intervention of NATO. Thomas Friedman, actually, though, is a New York Times columnist. He doesn't work for Stratfor. The idea of the Hezbollah having strategic interests, I think that makes sense, that if the Assad government is overthrown, they would lose a key ally in the region, so would Iran. The idea of cutting off funds to the extremist resistance is a good one. I'm not sure how you implement that. The question of when you do some of these things, so I think some of the things that we discussed are probably should be discussed at the peace conference and rather than seen as prerequisites, such as cutting off the funds. And I would be inclined to let Iran attend as well, since I can't see how you'd solve this problem without Iranian participation. My expectation is the U.S. is trying to bargain in advance for that attendance, but I think in the end, it would be difficult to deny Iran some presence in those talks. Mm.
But it looks to me, Mr. Wheats, that you're not supporting the idea that Western states, the U.S., or even coming out of the West, Israel, if you would talk about that as well, has interest in this, or is making moves from behind the scenes. Mr. Chandon was saying there that the Persian Gulf states are working as, you know, the hands of the West, the United States, etc. But I think you believe that the U.S. is not at all in any way involved or its ally Israel in the region.
No, I didn't say they weren't involved at all. I just think that the main drivers of what's going on there are the Gulf states, that includes Iran, includes the Saudis, the Qataris, and so on, Turkey, the groups in Lebanon, Jordan. Israel has basically intervened periodically to try and destroy weapons they think might divert towards Hezbollah. The United States and the West is eager to prevent the chemical weapons from doing the same. But, I mean, I think fundamentally the Assad government strategy has worked. The United States would like to remove Assad or place him with a coalition government, mm-hmm. one led by the opposition. But along with Israel and other Western governments, fears that what would happen is you'd end up with a worse outcome. You'd end up with an al-Qaeda state, which would be much more of a threat than Assad is at present. And if you allow me to draw this analogy, which you know your viewers probably will contest, the fear is you replace someone like the Shah of Iran with a government that is even more hostile to the West and even more threatening. And so I think in the end, a lot of this is a plague on both your houses. We want to minimize the balance, want to keep the conflict contained, but it's just not a major priority what happens in Syria. They're just much more important issues being debated, for at least in Washington and the Western capitals.
And that brings me to the next question, Mr. Chandon, if you may. The question of what is going to happen to Syria in the future, who is going to replace President Bashar al-Assad, and in Geneva too, will the Syrian people be given the opportunity the task of choosing their own leaders themselves without the interference of any other country? There are concerns that those countries who are funding a lot of the militia groups and who are not saying anything about the crimes that these groups are committing may want to decide for the Syrian people.
Just to say concede a correction to Mr. Weeks. I look forward to him conceding corrections for myself as well. It's Mr. Friedman at Jamestown, not Stratfor. I think that just going back to what Mr. Weeks said as well about that the fear in the Western capitals is Bashar Assad's government is replaced by something a lot more hostile is again, I think, deeply problematic. As well as deeply problematic, Mr. Weeks making out that somehow the West are just neutral arbitrators watching this big mess that the brown-skinned people are going through in the region. Libya, again, is the example that they much prefer a collapsed state run by crazy death squads than they would a unitary, cohesive state that's resistant, which was the Jamhuriya under Muammar Gaddafi. To Geneva too, I mean, I think really what's happened is that we have won at the negotiating table, that's the Syrian patriots, that what we've won at the, in the battlefield. So it's a reflection of the balance of forces in Syria and somewhat of the region. But obviously what the West will try to sabotage time again as strategy is any real formalized compromise with the Ba'athist government in Syria that recognizes that actually, you know, that they've actually fought this conspiracy, this violent conspiracy against this, what was a very peaceful and decent, one of the most peaceful coexistence between sects and faiths in the region, into a totally disastrous, bloody situation. And they want this bloody situation to perpetuate itself. And they're doing this. And one thing when Mr. Weeks is kind of correct is that Western capitals would much rather prefer brown-skinned people to achieve their own violent strategic aims than for putting Western boots on the ground itself, which creates a whole gamut of complications and problematics for Western capitals. Mm. But yes, also Mr. Weeks is right in as much as they, once they've kind of cut their losses, achieve what they have in the region, they're discussing much more important things, which is smashing the leadership of the Global South, whose capital is in Beijing. The Syrian people have an absolute right, and they have shown absolute steadfastness and formidable steadfastness in defending the gains of their revolution in Syria, and they have every right to be there, Geneva too. But London, Paris, and Washington, the last thing that they would ever respect is the absolute God-given and political rights of the people of the Global South.
Thank you very much. I'm afraid we've run out of time. A big thank you there to Mr. Sukant Chandan, independent filmmaker with us live from London. And thanks to our guest in Washington, Mr. Richard Weeks, senior fellow and director of the program management. Thank you so much, everyone, for staying with us here on The Debate. From me, Homa Lesgi, it's goodbye.